All right, one more and out the door. This last unit's chapter is called something like Broad Patterns of Evolution, which is a title that really refers to macroevolution. That's the topic of this chapter, as opposed to microevolution. And so far, all we've studied evolutionarily is microevolution. I gave you a definition of microevolution already. What is that? How do you define microevolution? That's exactly right. Change in allele frequency in a population over generations. In other words, a change in the values of P and Q in the Hardy-Weinberg model, right? That's microevolution. In other words, microevolution is evolution at the population level, which is why I said in that one slideshow that, yes, that bird is evolving if you're talking about the population when you say that bird or that species, but no if it means individual. Well, evolution certainly happens at the population level. That's microevolution. But you can also study evolution at bigger levels, broader levels, above the level of population, in other words. And all of that collectively is called macroevolution. So that's what we look at here. It has to do with much bigger groups and much bigger evolutionary trends involving huge taxa. Okay, so first, though, we're looking at slide one at the geologic record, as you see labeled. This is a table of the history of Earth. Geo means Earth, like in geology. And you can cheat and look, but does anyone know just offhand how old the planet is? It's also listed here. That's what I said about cheating. It's about 4.6 billion years, or 4,600 million years, which is 4.6 billion years. How does that compare with the age of the universe? What's the age of the universe? It's roughly 14 billion. So, universe is 10 billion years older than the Earth. The Earth as a planet, 4.6 billion years, and this table includes all those 4.6 billion years. Now, life on Earth is not as old as the age of the Earth. It took a while for the planet just to develop into a planet, and there was a long time before there was any organism. It was a completely lifeless Earth for roughly a billion years. A billion years, of which is a big chunk of 4.6 billion years, no life at all. So one thing I want you to realize by looking at this is that almost all of this detail is really just an expansion of that little piece of time at the top. If you look at the left edge of this table, you can see that the entire history of Earth geologically is broken into what are called eons, spans of time called eons. This is a hierarchical arrangement, kind of like kingdom, phylum, class, order, and so on. Eons are the biggest spans of time. They're not all equal in size. So there's not a definition based on number of years of what an eon is. It's based on what's happening. But eons are big, and notice that there is only 1, 2, 3, 4 eons. We're still in the fourth eon. So these are long spans. But then what is hierarchical about it is that geological eons are then, each eon is broken into shorter spans called eras, which are then, each of those is broken down into periods. And periods are broken down into epochs, just like a phylum is broken into classes, classes are broken down into orders, and so on. Okay. But the bottom part of this, which is the farthest back in time, this is at the beginning of the planet, that first eon is called the Hadean Eon. What does that name refer to? What does that mean? Hadean means like Hades. So it's hellish. Because it was a hot as hell place then. When the earth was becoming a planet, this was totally lifeless earth. The Hadean Eon is pre-biological. The planet's there, but no life yet. But that's why it was called Hadean, because it's such a hot place. And then the Archean, then the Proterozoic, and then the Phanerozoic, which is what we're living in. Well, that is when almost all of the familiar stuff came into existence. That's only the last half billion years. Even though it takes up most of the room on this table, all the way down to here, that really is just all the way up there. Okay? So you have 3.5 billion years of life. It took from 4.6 billion to 3.5 billion years ago before there was life. 4.6 years ago is the beginning of the planet. 3.5 billion years, roughly, is where we're putting the beginning of life. Those first successful cells that gave rise to all of us. And so, since that time, 3.5 billion years on, it's 6/7 of that, 3 billion years of that 3.5 billion years, it takes before you get to the Phanerozoic Eon that includes life on land. So never lose track of the fact that life started out in the oceans, and for a long time that's the only place there was life. It was a hell of a long time before you even got eukaryotes. The original organisms were prokaryotes, right? The prokaryotic cells. And, you know, those occur right here in the timeline. That's where we put the beginning of life, because they were the originals, 3.5 billion years. Well, almost 2 billion years of nothing but prokaryotes. Not until 1.8 billion years ago, roughly, you have the first eukaryotic cells. They were still single-celled organisms, but eukaryotes. And then from 1.8 billion till just 500 million years ago, you have nothing but, you have eukaryotes, but nothing big. No animals. Well, you have some animals in the ocean. No plants. Nothing living on land until 500 million years ago. Which is just a blink in the eye. Not to us, of course, but geologically speaking. And so all of this detail that you see, that all happened fairly recently. Slide 2 is another timeline. The gray arrow is a timeline here. Notice that it's broken in a couple places because it wouldn't fit if we put the whole thing on the slide. But it goes all the way back to 3.5 billion years ago, which is where we're starting life, based on evidence. We're not just saying, let's put it at 3.5 billion years. We have direct evidence that it's at least 3.5 billion years ago that life was present, because we have fossil evidence. So the big point of this slide is the importance of fossils to dating things and figuring out when things happened and how long things were around. Well, the very oldest fossils that we have are stromatolites, which you can see are almost as old as the oldest rocks on Earth. And they are the fossil remains of colonies of prokaryotes that look like rocks in a body of water here, but it's actually the fossilized remnants of a colonially living prokaryotic species. Well, then there's breaks, because this is a huge, this is 2 billion years here. And then once you get up to 600 billion years ago, where you have animals living in the ocean just about to invade land, that's when you start getting things that we're more familiar with, Well, the reason we're more familiar with that stuff is because we live on land, right? We encounter things that are on land. But still, all along this, I mean, we have a lot more kinds of fossils for land-dwelling animals because they're easier to find, but also because just in this last 500 million years in which there's been life on land, there's also just been a huge explosion of a speciation. And so there's been quite a hell of a lot of evolution packed into that last half billion years, this most recent half billion years. And that's reflected in the fossil record. Slide 3. Here we have a graph that can serve as a tool for dating fossils. The fossils are really important just because of the structural information they give us. But if you want to figure out when they occurred, it's really important to date them, right? Because when you talked about this, laying them down in strata, that gives you a relative date. What I mean by that is if you find a fossil in a deeper stratum and then find a different fossil in a more shallow stratum, you can tell that one is older than the other. That's relative dating, comparing it to something else, right? And that's useful, better than nothing, but it would be much better to be able to put absolute dates to fossils, meaning not whether they're older or newer than another fossil, but how many years absolutely are they old. That's much more valuable as a piece of information, right? And so we can do that for many fossils taking advantage of the fact that there are radioactive isotopes in nature. Now, first of all, what are isotopes? If you have a pair of atoms, what makes them isotopes? You've all had chemistry, haven't you? Or maybe not. Isotopes are atoms of the same element, but that differ in their number of neutrons. This brings up another fundamental question. How do you know what kind of element an atom is? There's only one thing that defines any given atom as a specific kind of element.
Protons.
The number of protons, and that is it. There are protons, neutrons, and electrons, right? Those are subatomic particles. The number of neutrons is the only thing that defines what kind of atom you're looking at. So something is a helium atom only because it has exactly two protons, and so on. Periodic table is all about that. Well, you can have different versions of the same element atomically because even though they have to have the same number of protons to be that kind of element, they can differ in their number of neutrons. And that's what isotopes are. So, for instance, you have run-of-the-mill hydrogen that most hydrogen is, just has a proton and an electron, no neutrons. But you also have heavy hydrogen, deuterium, still hydrogen because it has one proton, but it has a neutron as well. All right, and therefore, it's at least a little bit different. Well, when you get to farther down in the periodic table, the heavier elements, which have more and more neutrons, some of those isotopes that of any given element can be radioactive. You start having radioactivity, which is caused by instability, when the ratio of neutrons to protons gets very far away from one. The ratio being one means there's the same number of neutrons and protons. And that's more stable than having many more neutrons than protons or many more protons than neutrons, where the ratio would be not one. Anyway, when you have radioactive isotopes, they start decaying because they try to get more stable by losing particles. And when that happens, they turn into other stuff. All right? Well, we can take advantage of this in order to give absolute dates to fossils. For instance, you've probably heard of carbon dating. That's just one example of using radioisotopes to date things. You use carbon for a certain range of ages. It's not good for all ranges. And you use other elements for other ranges. But here in the graph, you have to understand the idea of a half-life, which is what's shown on the x-axis. A half-life is a time, it's a span of time, and each different kind of isotope is going to have a different value for its half-life. But what a half-life is the amount of time for half of that stuff that you originally had to no longer be there. It has turned into something else because of radioactive decay. Now notice that I didn't give you any amounts, absolute amounts. I just said half. In other words, if you start with a billion radioactive isotopes of whatever element you're working with, in one half-life, you're going to have 500 million left because half of that original amount is gone. But then if you wait exactly the same amount of time, you're not going to have zero. You're going to have half of that half billion. In other words, 250 million. Right? So it's not the same amount is disappearing. It's the relative amount that's disappearing. Half and then half of that and then half of that and so on. That's why this is a curve, not a line. All right? So it doesn't matter how many you start with. Half of whatever that is going to be left, one half-life left later. So the same amount of time it takes to get from a billion isotopes to 500 million, that's the same amount of time it takes to get from two isotopes to one, because one is half of two. Understand what I'm saying there? Well, if you, for the different kinds of isotopes, make these graphs, each isotope will have its own graph, based on real measurements of the decay, then that resulting curve that you fit to those data becomes what we call a molecular clock, because you can use it to put a date to fossils. Now, the reason that you can do this for fossils is because fossils started out as a living organism, even before the fossil, there was a living organism, right? And living organisms are made out of their surroundings. We are what we eat is literally true, right? Because the atoms that are in our body come from our surroundings, the things that we take into our body. And so we're going to have the same, we're going to take in radioactive isotopes and therefore have basically the same radioactive signature as our surroundings. But we're going to continuously be taking in fresh stuff as long as we're alive only. And then as soon as we die, we're no longer doing that. So that basically makes us like a rock rather than as something that is continuously renewing itself. And so that's the beginning of the clock, basically. And by measuring what fraction of the radioactive isotopes are left in that fossil, we can figure out how many half-lives it would take to get that much of a reduction. Does that make sense? So practically what happens is you measure a Y value, which is a fraction of parent isotope remaining in the fossil. And does it make sense that the older the fossil is, the fewer and fewer isotopes you have left, right? Because it's decayed. So you get a measurement of what's left. That would be a Y value. And then you just go directly horizontally over to the curve till it hits it, and then you go straight down and get an X value, which tells you how many half-lives must have passed. And since you know the half-life for that particular isotope, you can say this many years or this many millions of years. That gives us an absolute dating for fossils, which is much more valuable than relative dating. Okay, that is slide 3. Let's go to slide 4 and talk more about macroevolution, evolution at broad scales. Here, this is evolution occurring in the group that some of which became mammals, including us, represented here by the bear, but all mammals. All mammals is just one of the lineages of this tree that's shown, you see. So we mammals have an ancestor in common with reptiles and all the things shown here, if you go back far enough. Well, this is much above the level of population, right? These are huge groups. And the example shown here has to do with skull bones. So notice the dating here, 300 million years ago, 280 million years ago, and so on. So as you go through these skull cartoons, this is the most recent one, 195 million years ago. And the skull is made up of many different kinds of bones, but the important ones in this example are the ones that are colored rather than white. And what you see here is that some of these bones of the skull are involved in forming a hinge for the jaw. So one of the things that all these animals have in common, these reptiles and these amphibians and mammals, they all are jawed creatures. They have jaws. So that was evolutionarily, the original function of these skull bones, to form a hinge. And then in the lineage that it led to mammals, very gradually, over millions of years, these bones not only changed their shape, they changed their location as well in the skull, and they drastically changed their function. So that over these many millions of years, what were originally bones that were important as hinge bones became ear bones. You have the smallest bones in your body, by far, are your auditory ossicles. Ossicle just means small bone. Auditory means they have to do with hearing, right? And you've probably heard of the hammer, anvil, and stirrup bones, or malleus, incus, and stapes are their anatomical names, which just means hammer, anvil, and stirrup. But anyway, they're tiny bones, and they're in your middle ear. They evolved from bones in our ancestors that were important in forming that hinge. But in us, they no longer do that at all. They've taken on a completely new function, which is to amplify sound waves. The eardrum presses on the malleus, which then presses on the incus, which then presses on the stapes, and that is what amplifies the pressure. You only have so much pressure on the eardrum. You need more pressure than that in order for it to move fluid around so that it can be sensed by the brain. That's what these auditory ossicles have done. And so that's not just for us as a species or as a population because of microevolution. That's happened in a huge group of our ancestors. That's why it's an example of macroevolution. Slide 5. Well, obviously this is a phylogenetic tree. It's just a generic one because this isn't real examples. And even if it were, they're not listed what the examples are. The point here is something that probably isn't going to surprise you at all, because it's just common sense. The point here is that any given group, and here you have two groups defined by lineage A and lineage B, that group is going to, the size, I should say, of that group, how much it includes, how speciose it is, which is another way of saying how many species it has, that's going to depend on two major things. It's going to depend on how much speciation has occurred, obviously, right? Because speciation is creation of new species. And it's also going to depend on how much extinction has occurred, which is loss of species, right? Once things go extinct, they don't come back.
So that's just common sense, right?
More speciation, the more species you have, the more extinction, the fewer you have. And that's represented here by showing that B, lineage B, is more speciose, has more species in it, for both of these reasons. First of all, it has more speciation events, more nodes, but also it has less extinction. Each one of these little dagger symbols represents extinction, but since this has a timeline to it, you shouldn't even need these daggers, right? You can tell these are all extinct lineages because they don't make it all the way to present time. So that's pretty straightforward. Those two things drastically affect the size of a taxon. That brings us to 6. This is a cutaway view of the Earth. It's not drawn to scale, meaning that the crust is actually a lot thinner compared to the mantle than is shown here. If you draw it to scale, it's harder to see. But the crust, meaning this is the bedrock of the Earth, seems thick to us. It's so thick that we can't drill all the way through it. But it's a tiny fraction of the diameter of the planet. It also seems, from our point of view, that it is solid and it's been there for a long time. But really, the crust, which we all live on, is just a thin, it's pieces of thin rafts that are floating on a liquid interior. The mantle and core are sloshing around at a global scale. So this is not solid like the crust is. And the crust is really just floating on this liquid beneath it. Now, why is that important to biology? It's important to geology, of course. But why is it important to biology? Well, for what's shown here in slide 7, this is a map of the familiar names of continents, but it's not like a map that you see of current day Earth, right? The continents have been moved around so that they fit together kind of like pieces of a puzzle. Well, this is how plate tectonics as a science got started. Someone looking at maps said, you know, it looks like if you move these things around, they'd fit together. Once we figured out the shapes of the continents, looks like they would fit together if you're allowed to slide them around. And therefore, if you reverse that process, you can say that they have already been slid from a position where they were together. That's the hypothesis, and there's, when you go looking for evidence for that, we can say that that actually is what happened. So this is a map of where these things were a long time ago when they were still part of the same landmass. And then they have separated since that time because, like I said, these, what we think of as permanent solid crust of the Earth, is really just rafts floating around. And they can move apart from each other and are doing so very slow rate from our point of view continuously. So that's plate tectonics. And the reason that's important to biology is because a lot of the organisms on Earth are just passengers on those rafts. And wherever plate tectonics takes them, that's where they have to go, right? If they're going to continue living on that landmass. So plate tectonics, or the shifts of continents, is a way for isolation to occur. Isolation between groups that used to live together because they're going on different rafts as the land masses move apart from each other. Well, we can see that in slide 8. This is another timeline of the last quarter billion years, 250 million years ago. All of the Earth's land masses were together in one huge land mass that we call Pangaea, which means all of Earth. So that's the correct map for a quarter billion years ago. It doesn't look right yet. I mean, it's not what we're used to.
And then eventually, 100 million years roughly, that one big landmass, Pangaea, split up into two major ones, Laurasia and Gondwana. And then 65 million years ago, as you see, you have separate continents that we're familiar with by name, but they're not in the right places according to current maps, right? When you get up to 45 million years ago, it's starting to look right from our maps, and they're still moving. And so this has happened several times. 250 million years ago is just the last time they were all stuck together. But they occasionally, over hundreds of millions of years, collide into one and then separate again. It's just happening over and over. But 250 million years ago, well, that's a big chunk. That's half of the time that there have been land-dwelling organisms. Remember I said we've only been on land, not humans. We've only haven't even existed a million years. But organisms in general have only been on land for twice the amount of time that this map shows. But it's been happening many times through the billions of years. Slide 9. Another tree to look at, phylogenetic tree. But this one's a little bit different, which I'll explain in a minute. But look at the maps below it. This is what I was just talking about in words before. Here you have two land masses that are very close to each other, red and the blue here, 88 million years ago. And so that represents the node here on the tree. They were living together, basically, right? But because of continental drift, which is what these tectonic shifts are called, continental drift moves big land masses gradually. Now, well, not 56 million years ago is what we see here. It's even more extreme now. These two land masses are no longer close to each other. So that is a very gradual allopatric speciation, right? They've gone on different rafts to different parts of the world, isolated from each other, which is why it's allopatric. And it's not surprising that there are two different lineages now in the tree. Well, the part about the tree being a little bit different, what's different about it is the shape, right? In all the trees phylogenetic trees we've looked at so far, the lineages were just nice straight lines, right? Here we have lineages that differ in their width as you go through time. They flare out. And that widening or flaring out of the lineage represents what's called adaptive radiation. Adaptive radiation refers to how much speciation occurs within a lineage. In other words, how many species get created from a starting lineage in a given amount of time. And the wider that lineage is depicted on the phylogenetic tree, the more species, the more nodes are really included in that if you got in there and looked at the detail. So what you see here is that adaptive radiation occurred in both of these major lineages of frogs, but not equally so, right? One of these lineages, in terms of adaptive radiation, has been much more successful, has led to many more species. The wider one, notice, 310 species, the narrower one, 100 species. But that's what we mean by adaptive radiation. And it happens for various reasons, but it's not. The point is that it's not equal from lineage to lineage. All right, now to 10. Here we have a graph of extinction rates on the y-axis. That's for the red line. Notice it's really a double graph. The blue line is number of families that exist at any given time. But the red line is extinction rate. And extinction is the elimination of taxa, right?
elimination of a species or of a genus. But they're gone. It's permanent removal. An extinction is naturally occurring. There's been extinction occurring the entire history of life. Just like there's speciation that occurs, there's extinction that occurs, right? Things die out for various reasons. They can't make it. So extinction per se is not really troubling. I mean, it's obviously troubling if you're the one going extinct, but it's not. It's you wouldn't ever expect there to be no extinction. It's just part of biology. What's troubling, though, is that so in other words, it's not a constant extinction rate. It goes up and down a little bit. It hops around just like noise in a graph. But it's at some low baseline level, usually. Just going up and down a little bit, like static. What's troubling is when the rate gets much greater all of a sudden. So it's not extinction that's troubling, it's a drastic increase in the rate of extinction that occurs for various reasons intermittently throughout time. And when that happens, when there's a huge increase in the rate of extinction, we call it a mass extinction event. And in the past, once again, 500 million years, basically the history of life on land, there's been 5 mass extinction events. And you can see these by the parts of the red trace that get really high all of a sudden compared to the surrounding areas. And each of these is given a name, basically name for when they occur on the in the geologic time scale. We're going to only talk about 2 of these big 5. One, because it's the biggest one of all of them, right there in the middle. This is called the Permian extinction. There are various names for it, but Permian extinction is one name. And that's what this P here stands for. This is the Permian period within the Paleozoic era. Well, at the end of that Permian period is when this Permian extinction occurred. That's what it's named for. And this was the biggest mass extinction in the last 500 million years, since there were animals, plants alive. Uh, 90% of groups of organisms were eliminated. That's a huge extinction event. And obviously that's a fundamental change to the biology of Earth when you only have 10% of things surviving. Well, that's a biggie. So that's why we're talking about that one. The most recent one, which is only 65.5 million years ago, but also pretty tall, is the Cretaceous extinction. That's what this C stands for. So once again, it's named for the period, the end of which this happened. The Cretaceous wasn't quite as severe, but 3/4 of all groups of organisms disappeared in the Cretaceous. The Cretaceous is the one that killed almost all the dinosaurs. The only dinosaurs that survived are the things that we nowadays call birds. And we were talking before about how birds are the only dinosaurs that survived. Well, this is the mass extinction that they survived. All the others were killed, and most of the other things as well, not just dinosaurs. By the way, this really opened up possibilities for mammals. This is where mammals exploded when the dinosaurs were eliminated. And so we wouldn't have come into existence if it weren't for that. But from a global perspective, any mass extinction is a huge, hugely important event. So these are the big 5. There's a lot of troubling aspects to this. Obviously these were troubling events for the organisms that lived then. But the troubling part of this story is that it looks like we are at the beginning of the next mass extinction, because extinction rates are getting out of hand quickly. They're increasing very rapidly. Now, even the most recent of these cannot at all be blamed on humans, because humans didn't exist 65 million years ago. But this, if we are at the beginning of the next mass extinction, the worst part of that is that we are causing it. Human activity is actually what is causing this extinction rate to increase, and maybe will be the mass extinction, which will certainly include us when it happens. Humans are among the species that are the most likely to go extinct when it takes most of the things. The ones that will survive will be the bacteria that have always been here, but we'll be gone. So that's troubling in its own right, the fact that we are causing a mass extinction. But it's even more troubling when you compare the causes to the extinction rate increase that's happening now to what caused the Permian extinction, the biggest extinction ever. This was caused for multiple factors, but a major contributor to the Permian extinction was out-of-control volcanic activity that caused global warming. And the global warming wiped almost everything out. Well, that's exactly what we're doing now, because of human activity that is causing things to go extinct way higher, at a much higher rate than they should in the background level. Well, just to put some pictures to this, these aren't photographs, obviously. There wasn't photography 65 million years ago, but or photographers for that matter. But slide 11 is an artist's rendition of what it likely caused. Evidence is pretty good that this was caused substantially, at least, if not entirely caused, by, this is the Cretaceous extinction, I should have said that, by collision of an object with the planet 65 million years ago. This is the thing that wiped out the dinosaurs, the non-avian dinosaurs, and most other things, but not our ancestors, obviously. Anyway, with asteroid, whatever it was, a big, big chunk hit the Earth very hard, spewing up so much debris that it basically blocks out photosynthesis for a long time, and things start dying because we all depend on photosynthetic organisms indirectly or directly. And so when you do the math of how big this thing would have to be in order to do the calculated damage, then you can figure out how big a scar it would leave based on those computations. And if you use satellites to look at Earth from space, you can actually see the scar near off the coast of Mexico, just about as big as it should be as calculated. So that at least happened. There might have been other factors involved as well, but compared to the other mass extinctions, the Cretaceous could have been immediate, like in decades. The others took maybe 100,000 years or so for the entire blip in the graph to occur. This could have been very quick. Okay, slide 12, more troubling news for humans. Here, this is a graph of extinction rate on the y-axis versus temperature. So this is why global warming is such a big deal. All of these dots are real data of extinctions. The black ones are kind of run-of-the-mill extinctions. The five red ones are the five big mass extinctions that we just talked about. And the most troubling aspect of this is that all of those red ones, most of those red ones, four of the five, occur in the upper right. It's high because it's a huge extinction rate. That's what makes it mass extinction. But it's the troubling aspect is that three of these things are way off to the right, meaning they happened because of warmer temperatures. So these are only 1 degree, 2 degrees, 3 degrees, which we're predicting happening soon because of human activity. And that's why I was comparing global warming, human-caused global warming, to the Permian extinction. The biggest problem that humans have ever faced. Okay, 13. This is kind of an interesting graph to look at based on what happens after mass extinction events. Obviously, the things that go extinct are no longer there. They're finished. But for the ones that are so-called lucky enough to survive, they now all of a sudden are living in a completely different world, right? Because most living things have been eliminated. And so that obviously affects ecology, which is how things interact with other living things. This is just one example of how the ecology changes. Each time there's been a mass extinction, when you look at the fossils to determine this, the surviving population becomes made up of a bigger and bigger percentage of predators. So the world becomes more dangerous, really, in a sense, and because the bigger fraction you have that are predators, the more things are eating each other, right? And I'm sure there's all kinds of complex reasons why that happens, but it's just an ecologically interesting thing about surviving mass extinctions. Well, this is a mammal tree. This is the corner of the overall tree of life that just includes mammals, which of course is our own group. And once again, we can see adaptive radiation illustrated by this tree. And once again, it's not equal for different lineages. This is even more severe. I'll talk more about mammals in a different chapter, but there are three major kinds of mammals represented by the three lineages here. There are monotremes, there are marsupials, and there are eutherians. Well, monotremes are the basal lineage. Do you recognize that based on the definition of basal taxon? It's the one that comes directly from the ancestral, the node that defines the whole clade. Marsupials and eutherians then split apart from the other branch from that itself split from monotremes. Well, anyway, there are living or extant examples of all three of these still, but in the case of monotremes, just barely, there's only a few species still remaining. And so they have undergone far less adaptive radiation than either of the other two lineages. And in terms of adaptive radiation, if that's the measure of success, then our own branch of mammals, which is the eutherians, that's the one humans belong to, has been by far the most successful in terms of adaptive radiation. That's where most, you know, any mammal that you can just randomly think of, it's likely going to be a eutherian mammal. Well, adaptive radiation doesn't apply to just animals, of course. Any organisms, whether they're even eukaryotic or prokaryotic, it happens. But here's a plant example, slide 15, using Hawaii as an example. Now, the Hawaii is an archipelago, right? A group of islands. And it's an expanding group of islands because they're continuously coming into existence. They're lava, right? It's a volcanic set of islands, so new ones are being created as eruptions occur. And they're very young in terms of geologic time. So just all of a sudden, you have an island appearing in the middle of the ocean, far away from any landmass, that now that it exists, really represents a whole exploited place to live. And so natural selection can really just run amok in these places because there's no competition at first, right? And that's why even in a group of islands that are very close to each other and have similar conditions but not identical conditions, can start out with an ancestor and because of speciation by natural selection lead to drastically different species in a pretty short amount of time because this brand new land is coming up and therefore natural selection operates differently. But it's another example of adaptive radiation, right? Starts with the original one, which is more or less this bottom one. This is how the ancestor looked and radiated into many different species. Okay, that brings us to 16, which is a little bit of a shift in gears. This has to do with development. Well, not just development, but it has to do with the fact that when you look at broad evolution, in other words, macroevolution, obviously you can see that there are major differences morphologically between different species, like in this case, humans and chimpanzees. And when you see major differences, it's tempting to think, well, there must be major differences in their DNA to account for these huge morphological differences. But the major point that this and several slides after this are making is that you don't have to have a huge difference in DNA to have hugely different traits in different species. And that's why chimpanzees are shown here, because chimpanzees are our closest living relatives. Like I said before, there have been other species within the genus Homo, but they've all gone extinct except for sapiens, which is us, right? But if you can concentrate on just the things that are still alive, chimpanzees are genetically our closest relatives, phylogenetically our closest, and genetically they are almost identical. 99% identical to humans. 98, 99, whatever it is. Very close. Despite that almost identical genome, though, we have no problem telling a human apart from a chimpanzee, right? They're drastically different. We can see this in just the skulls. We don't even have to have the living organisms. If you compare a chimpanzee skull to a human skull, on the right, major differences, right? The brain case or the cranium of humans is much bigger because it holds a correspondingly bigger brain, whereas the chimpanzee has a much more powerful and bigger jaw. Well, these drastic differences are not because of drastic differences in DNA. We have basically the same DNA for the shape of these skulls. What's going on here is that the different parts of the skull develop at different rates as the organism is developing, but using the same sets of genes in both species. This is an example of what we call heterochrony. Now, hetero means different, right? Chron means time. So heterochrony refers to differences in developmental time. Heterochrony will cause one body part to develop much faster than other body parts in that same amount of time. And that's why, for instance, in humans, the brain case can get so much bigger than the rest of the skull. But in chimpanzees, the jaw can get so much bigger than the rest of the skull, using the same genes. Now, why can this be? Well, think about what genes are. The vast majority of genes are protein-coding genes, right? So-called because the type of RNA that they code for, all genes code for RNA, right? But protein-coding genes code specifically for messenger RNA, which then codes for proteins, amino acid sequences that become proteins. And Those proteins are what give the organisms their traits. We've said this several times. But a gene is not always turned on. It's not always being expressed. There's gene expression when you're reading that manual and building the protein. But not all genes are on. In your body, every one of your cells has the same library of genes, right? So your hepatocytes, your liver cells, could be making fingernails or any other body part. You don't want that to happen most of the time, right? They need to be busy making the stuff that only hepatocytes need to do their job. So even though they have the whole library, most of their genes are turned off for your whole lifetime. And still, and even the ones that are turned on, they're not continuously turned on. They're turned on when they're needed, right? So, heterochrony occurs because you'll have the same set of genes in all cells, but some of those genes will be turned on at certain times in development and others won't. So they'll be turned on in certain cells of the developing body and not in other cells. That's how a body part can get bigger, for instance, compared to the rest of the body. And so there are what are called developmental genes. Now they are protein-coding genes just like other protein-coding genes. But they're called developmental genes because the proteins that those first genes code for they act as switches that will turn on or off other genes during development. Okay? So this is how you can have the same genes basically, but if you switch them on and off differently in two different species, you're going to end up having drastically different morphologies and look so different as chimps and humans do. Even though it's effectively the same DNA. It's how you use the DNA that really makes the difference in this case. Well, we see another example of that in 17. This is heterochrony in a bat. It's a fellow mammal, so it has the same hand and arm bones that we do, same number, and they have the same names. But obviously it's much bigger compared to the rest of its body than our arm and hand is, right? Because it's doing a completely different job. It's the framework for the skin that becomes the wing of the bat. Well, this is drastically different from us, but not because the DNA is so much different. It depends on the developmental genes. Yes, it's caused by mutation. There's mutation that causes differences in the DNA. But if the DNA differences happen to occur in those developmental genes, but the rest of the DNA is basically the same, then the rest of that DNA that's the same is going to be used differently because of those developmental genes being different. And that's how you can have such a drastic difference. But that's heterochrony because the arm and hand is outgrowing, it's outpacing the growth of the rest of the body. That's different timing. Still another example is 18. This is a specific case of heterochrony called pedomorphosis. Now, osis means condition, morph means shape or form, and pedo, what does that mean? It doesn't have to have the A in it. What does pedo mean? What is it? Well, yeah, that's one use of it, but there's another use of it. Yeah, youth. Juveniles, right? A pedophile, for instance. So pedomorphosis means the condition of having juvenile form in adulthood. This is a salamander that looks very much like a undeveloped salamander in a different species. One that will not look like this in adulthood because it undergoes metamorphosis. Well, this one still has these gills even in adulthood. So it looks like a juvenile form. That's why it's pedomorphosis. Well, once the same old story. This looks drastically different compared to the other salamander species, and you'd expect it to be because there's drastic differences in DNA. Not true. It's because they have minor differences in the developmental genes that control the other genes that are the same. Largely the same thing happening in 19 with Drosophila, as an example, compared to Artemia or brine shrimp. Sea monkeys, if you buy them from the back of comic books, but it's all the same stuff. Well, these are, once again, drastically different in form. They have drastically different amounts of legs. But once again, this is not because of huge DNA differences. What determines whether legs crop up from a body part or not are whether, or what's happening with what are called Hox genes. Hox genes are examples of homeotic genes, which are developmental genes that control major body parts, control the development of major body parts. And so the brine shrimp doesn't have many more legs because its genes are so much different. It's just that the Hox genes are turned on in a greater fraction of its body than they are in Drosophila. Insects have exactly 6 legs. Other kinds of arthropods have a different amount of legs. But you can see this go wrong. I mean, a normal Drosophila has 6 legs, just like any other insect. But in mutant forms of Drosophila, since these are used so often in genetic experiments, every once in a while mutations happen. And if a mutation happens in a Hox gene so that it gets turned on in the wrong part of the body, you'll see an otherwise perfectly formed leg. It looks just like a normal leg, but it'll be coming out of the eyeball, for instance. Because every part of the body has the ability to do that. That's my point. And the reason we have such differences is because of when genes get turned on or off and where they do in the body. And yet one more example of this is in slide 20, using these stickleback fish, two different species that differ in their spininess. They both have mouth spines, hard parts, but only one of them has ventral spines farther back on the body. And so this one's an experimental one. The question is, are these two species differing in this trait of having or not having these ventral spines because of DNA differences or because of developmental genes being at play? In other words, the expression of the genes. And the results is the latter. It's because of how the genes are turned on or off. So you look at the huge variety of life that we have, and that's originally caused by mutations, but there has to be differences in DNA for that to occur. But you shouldn't explain away all the variations simply by mutation of every single gene. You can have large-scale macroevolution, in other words, large-scale differences that are due simply to small mutations in genes that control other genes. 21, I think this is the last slide of the day, and the unit. Here we have evolutionary history of eyes, in a sense, but the point that this slide makes is that large-scale changes in macroevolution do not happen overnight. Just in one, by a simple mutation causing, for instance, the existence of an eyeball, fully formed eyeball when there wasn't one. Well, this is often used, particularly this eye example, is often used by people who choose not to believe in evolution. They will say something like, well, if evolution happens in steps, how do you explain an eyeball? Because you can't have half an eyeball, you're still blind. So how does that happen? How does it happen all in one step? Well, that's a fallacious argument, because you're not blind if you have half an eyeball. There's a little advantage along the way at each step. So for instance, if you are an organism that has no ability to sense light, obviously it would be an advantage just to say yes or no whether light is present, right? And that can happen with simply a little patch on the skin of pigmented cells. Pigments are molecules that are able to absorb photons, and so they can respond to light. Now, this is not an eye. This animal is not seeing anything. But it's able to detect whether light is shining on its surface or not. It's not forming an image. It's just detecting light. That's not an eye yet, right? But that is an advantage already compared to ones that do not have that. And that's caused by simple mutation. Well, if you already have that, remember, I said before that one of the reasons not only is evolution gradual, but it's really just always adjusting what it was there before. It's not designing anything from scratch. It's just working with what's already there and then changing it because of natural selection. So if you already have that simple patch of photosensitive cells in a lineage, a next advantage because of a new mutation would be to invaginate that patch. To invaginate means to form an in-pocketing. So this one's just on the surface, right, a flat surface. But if that light-sensitive patch of cells is now within a little cave rather than being on the surface, that's even better. Still not forming an image, but the advantage of having it in a little cave where the light-sensitive cells are down here is that now not only can you tell whether light is there or not, you can also now tell which direction the light is coming from. Because if it's in this cave and light's coming this way, only these cells are being illuminated. If it's coming from this way, only these cells are being illuminated because the other ones are in the shade. See that? So that's another advantage, and natural selection works that way. And then if it becomes even more and more invaginated so that it almost closes off and therefore can contain a droplet of water, then that droplet of water acts as a rudimentary lens, and therefore the light rays are starting to bend. They're being refracted by this. And so now you're starting to have not only sensing the direction of the light, but you have the first image formation. Okay? It's not auto-focusing, but it is focusing because the light is bending the rays. I mean, the water is bending the rays. And then and the next step after that evolutionary would be to have it totally seal off and have an actual cellular structure made out of cells be its own lens. And that, of course, makes the focus even better, which is an advantage. And then just like in our eyes, the next step would be to have muscles connect to that lens, which can pull on that lens or just let it be, and therefore change its thickness, which is what allows us to autofocus when we look at different distances. That's called accommodation. Just like an autofocus camera does, we change our lens thickness. Well, autofocusing cameras don't do that. They change the lens position. Actually, fish eyes work that way. Our eyes autofocus by changing the thickness of the lens. Fish eyes change it focus by actually moving the lens farther, just like a camera does. So that's another good point about this. The advantages are so great at each step that this actually happened independently in many different lineages. Not all eyeballs are related. There are analogous eyeballs independently occurring in different organisms, not because of common ancestry, because it's such an advantage at each level. So no, it doesn't happen all in one step because it doesn't have to. And that's the argument. All right, that's enough for me.